All right, hi everybody, and welcome to Lecture 30 in this Ancient History program of History at Our House for the elementary class. This is the last lecture of new material in part 2 of the course. So next week is going to be a test week, and it is also going to be a little bit of an unusual week because Wednesday is Veterans Day. So we have a day off in the middle of our week, which is the tricky part there. So what we're going to be doing is reviewing the material on Monday, everything that we covered up to today on Monday, and then we're going to have History Through Art on Tuesday. That's the really unusual part of everything to make room for Wednesday. Wednesday is Veterans Day, so we will certainly observe that and honor America's veterans. And then Thursday we will return, and I will give you the test preparation sheets on Monday, and we'll return on Thursday then to work on your answers to that. So, just as we were trying to establish a routine here of how test weeks work, we're going to have an unusual one coming up next week. But anyway, we can do it. We can manage it. And so today, in our last lecture on the archaic world of the ancient past, I'm calling today's lecture the climax of archaism. Ooh, those are kind of big words right there. I mean, not big in terms of the number of letters, but they are big in terms of the ideas. What is a climax? What is that? In a movie, for instance, in a story, in a novel, you will get a climax at the end. And usually, you know, the writer, if in a good story, right, the tension goes up and goes up and goes up, and then near the end of the story, you have the most exciting moment, the most important and exciting moment. That's what we call the climax. Okay? So this is what we are about to study here. The Persian Empire is the climax of a certain progression of ancient peoples. There is no archaic empire greater than the Persian Empire. But what we're going to see is, once we get past this, we're going to move to a new level. We're going to have a different way of life that's better, and that's going to lead to the progress that creates modern civilization. So an archaic way of life is going to go away. We don't have to live at that level anymore. But archaism is just a short way of saying the archaic way of organizing human life. Okay? So, if that is the case, who could put this title in their own words now? Just like we do with History Through Art, when I give a title, you can put it back into your own words. How would you take these two words and turn them into your own word, just to show, because I want to make sure before we begin that you got what I just said. So how would you restate in your own words the title, The Climax of Archaism? Can anybody do it? All right, I'm going to do it, and then you're going to have to repeat after me. The most important and exciting part of archaic history. Patrick, say that again? Oh, that's not good. Patrick is distracted today, everybody. You know why? Because it's his birthday.
No, I just forgot.
Yeah, you guys can you can chat him a happy birthday wish if you like. It's his birthday, but also he wasn't paying attention.
So,
no, you weren't, because I can see you were daydreaming.
No, okay. I wasn't.
Okay, so what did I say?
Just forgot.
No, you didn't forget. It's impossible to forget if I say something and I ask you to repeat it. All right, so I don't want to put my son on the spot here and make him feel bad on his birthday. But everybody, the climax of archaism, this strange phrase that I have explained now is, means, the most important and exciting part of the story of archaic history. Go ahead again. Julia, in your own words, please.
It's the most important, exciting point in archaic history.
Okay, fine. There we go. That's what it is. Okay, that's what this means. The climax of archaism. A way of life. All right, it is the Persian Empire. And it is the climax because, well, it is the biggest fish in the progression of the fish eating the other fish, right? That is part of it. So in the story of the archaic world, when you're little Egypt over here and you've been all by yourself, that's going to work out okay for you. But when Assyria comes along, then you're in big trouble. But Assyria gets in trouble because it has a powerful set of neighbors, allies, called Media and Neo-Babylonia. We kind of skipped over them, except that we said that the rulers of Babylon, the New Babylon, that's what Neo means, the New Babylon, made the Hanging Gardens of Babylon and other great structures and so on. So they were quite impressive. But finally, the climax of this progression is Persia. Okay, the Persian Empire. It's going to swallow up everything else. So, how come Persia gets to be the biggest fish? How come it didn't start off as the biggest fish? It became, in a sense, it became the biggest fish in this progression of events. So let's go to our map of the Persian Empire here. Where is that? Sorry, I got to bring that up. And I have it over here. Let me take you to a kind of an older version of this map here. Oh, we're not going to put that up. That's a cute little thing that I found. Anyway, let's make it bigger so that you can see it more clearly. Okay, this is kind of an old version of the map of the Persian Empire. Do you see the two rivers here? That's Mesopotamia, right? And you can see the word Babylon here. And you can see the word Assyria here. And here you can see the word Media, which is pretty big. This whole area up here was the land, the homeland of the Medes. Down here was the smaller part called Persis or Persia. So this is where the Persians were from. They were related to the Medes. And they were kind of cousins, and this is where the Persians were from. So they didn't start off with anything more than everybody else. They became the biggest fish, and became the most powerful empire in the history of the archaic world. So how did they do it? Right? How do we understand? How did some ancient kingdom, small, not any bigger than any other, not any wealthier or any more powerful particularly than any other, how did they do this? How did they create the greatest empire in the archaic world? Well, here is ingredient number one to the success of the Persian Empire. Ingredient number one is great leadership. Great leadership. Right? So if you're going to have a great empire, you have to have great leaders. Give me one second here to go back to this Wikipedia, our favorite place here. And I'm going to bring up the page of a character named Cyrus the Great, or as the Persians would have pronounced it, Cyrus. So Cyrus the Great is the first of the great charismatic leaders. Here's his emblem. The emblem of Cyrus the Great. It looks pretty cool, right? With the wings and everything like that. And the amazing kind of crown here. So he is the first of the great kings. Rosetta has a question or comment. So go ahead, Rosetta.
What's charismatic mean?
Oh, that's so great. Thank you, Rosetta, for asking. See, whenever Mr. Powell uses a big word, you're supposed to do that. Rosetta, you might be the first one who ever did that. Congratulations. So, I used the word charismatic, and nobody's hand flew up, except Rosetta's, to say, hey, Mr. Powell, wait a minute. I don't know what that word is. You just used a big word, and you're not allowed to do that without explaining what it is, mister, because you're supposed to be a teacher. All right, so let me put the word charismatic there, and that is related to another word, which is a shorter almost the same word, charisma. Charisma. Okay? Very good word, very important word. Charisma is an energy that somebody has to impress other people. An ability to be a leader. An ability to understand how to get people to do what you want them to do. How to convince people that what you are saying is right. And that you are the one that they should follow. People that become great leaders have to have charisma. So, that is a really interesting word. So thank you, Rosetta, for asking that, okay? It is the energy that a person has to influence and even control other people. Some people have that great ability, and they tend to be the leaders. So nowadays, probably the most charismatic person that you might be aware of out there would be Donald Trump. He's a guy that is really, he commands attention when people are paying attention to him, which is why a lot of people are interested in him as possibly the next president of the United States. He has a lot of charisma. Whether or not that's going to happen, we shall see. But pretty much any leader has to have charisma. So most presidents and most leaders and so on have a certain charisma. All right, so that is the energy of the leader. And so we call that, when somebody has that, they are a charismatic leader. And Cyrus the Great was the first charismatic leader of the Persian Empire. And just quickly, where is it? I can't see everything on my messy script. Mr. Charismatic Leader, what did he do? Darius. We have Cyrus the Great. We have the story of these leaders. Cyrus the Great is not the one who did this. Pardon me. See, I got myself confused. It's going to be his descendant, Darius. So forget that. I got confused. So Cyrus, however, was the first of the great leaders of the Persian Empire. And he is the one most responsible for this gigantic conquest. Okay, so he managed to take control. Not only was he king of Persia, but he managed to take control of the Medes. Nobody knows how. Did they have a war? Did they have this or that? We don't know how, because these people did not have history themselves. They were very much stuck in the archaic past. But people, their neighbors, like the Assyrians and the Babylonians, did have history. And it took a while for the record of the events to really reveal what was going on over here. But Cyrus was a great conqueror, and he is responsible for most of this stuff that you see here being in green over to the left in particular. And then, after having conquered this eastern part of his empire, which is more empty and definitely not as populous and civilized as this part over here, never has been. But nonetheless, he really conquered this whole area, part of what we call Afghanistan today, and countries like that, in that area. Then he came back over here, and he conquered what we call Turkey, which back then was called Lydia. And then he conquered Babylon. And so he was creating this massive empire. So he was very, very successful in doing that. And when he got to Babylon, he did something which made him, well, pretty famous. Turns out he will always be remembered as a great leader by the Jewish people. Because when the, remember how we talked about last time how the people of Judea were treated by the Assyrians? What did the Assyrians do to them? I'll help you to understand that when we, Rosetta, go ahead.
They took them from their homes.
Took them and did what with them?
And put them somewhere else.
Yeah, forced them into exile. Forced them somewhere else. What do we call this? That was, we've had our fair share of vocabulary words lately. What was this vocabulary word to describe the exile, the dispersion of the Jewish people away from their homeland? That was part of your self-test, if you had the opportunity to do that or to see the answers to it. What's the word for the spreading out of the Jewish people away from their homeland, Rosetta?
Diaspora?
Yeah, diaspora. There you go. Okay, good. So that's another tricky word. So we've had our fair share of tricky words. So that just means being spread out into exile, away from your homeland. So the reason why Cyrus became a beloved conqueror by the Jewish people is when he conquered Babylon, he let them go home. He said, basically, go. And he did something else because he wasn't a nice guy. He was a conqueror. So he let them go home and he let them rebuild their religious temples, which they thought was fantastic. And basically, the secret ingredient that Cyrus was going to teach the Persians for making a successful empire, this was very special, unique to the Persian Empire. In all of the other empires that we have seen, it didn't work this way. Only the Persians got this one. So the unique thing that the Persians did was they tolerated other people's religions. Okay? Or to put it in a very short phrase, we could just say one of the secrets to Persian power was religious toleration. Okay? That was a special part of the Persian Empire. Nobody else before that had learned to do it. In fact, what happened before the Persians was, anytime one city in Mesopotamia would conquer another, what people believed was that the god of the conquering city had defeated the god of the defeated city. So, this is a lot like, in any archaic culture, where you see this strong belief that anything that happens in the world is actually really controlled by some kind of supernatural power. So, if, for instance, there's a flood of the Nile, well, that's not because there was rain, that's because the gods made it flood. And in this case, if one city defeats another city, well, that's because there's a contest between their gods and the god of one city defeats the other. So in the time of the Babylonians, the most powerful god was called Marduk. And look how similar he is to the king Cyrus. Isn't that interesting? Very similar representation, right? And so Marduk was the god of the city of Babylon. And so you can see, if you go to Wikipedia, you can learn about Hammurabi worshipped Marduk, and all, you know, the Babylonians had made Marduk the most important of the gods. But along with that came the fact that you had to worship Marduk. No matter what your gods were, or even if you had only one, like the Jewish people did, well, if you didn't worship Marduk as the number one god, then you were in big trouble. So this is part of why the Jewish people were treated so badly by the Assyrians and the Babylonians, because they refused to do that sort of thing. They held to their belief and refused to accept the god Marduk. So when Cyrus came and conquered Babylon and freed the Jews and sent them home and said, you guys can rebuild your temples and you can have your own god. Well, that was an impressive thing. They really felt like... So throughout history, to the Jewish people, Cyrus has been a historical hero. And in fact, it's really quite fascinating, because up until only very recently, which is very sad, but up until very recently, Persia and Israel have been very close friends. And this was up until quite a while ago, only until basically the Muslim leaders took over Persia, Iran, now, did it become enemies of Israel. But they had a good relationship up until that point because of how well the Persians treated the Jews. And there are stories behind that as to why people acted that way. But basically, you know, the most important thing is that Cyrus and the other Persian kings were tolerant of other religions. So you could see how that would help them to rule people. Because, I mean, what are the reasons why are empires so hard to keep going? Right? Why are they so hard to maintain? You're going to conquer people. You're going to force them to give some of their food and some of their wealth, right? Rosetta, go ahead.
Because they're probably always going to be rebelling against you and hating you.
Yes, right. So now, what are the reasons for rebelling? Well, one of the reasons is just material life and material necessities. If you are taxed, if you are ruled, and it's just physically and just in a material way very hard to tolerate, that's one thing that leads people to rebel. But another thing that is a very strong motive for people throughout history is their religious beliefs. So when that is taken away from them, that often also causes them to want to rebel. So the Persians were really smart. They wanted to rule. They weren't nice guys. Okay, they were not, they didn't think, oh, let us respect the rights of people and let everybody have his own religion. Right? They would never have believed in something like the First Amendment. And what they wanted was to rule. And what they understood was, it's easier to rule people if you let them keep their religion. Because you're taking away one of the reasons why they would rebel against you. Pretty smart. So that is why we have, that is one of the main reasons that we have this climax of archaic kingship and monarchy. The Persians were really smart in the way that they organized their empire. And one part of this religious toleration that was unique to the Persian Empire is shown by the way that the pharaoh Cambyses conquered Egypt. So Cambyses II was the one that conquered Egypt. He was the son of Cyrus. So as you can see here, it says son of Cyrus the Great. And he conquered Egypt, and he did something quite fascinating. In order to rule over Egypt, and in order to follow the idea of religious toleration. In order to follow this, you know, special method of tolerating the religious beliefs of the people that you conquered, guess what he did? Something very, very clever. He became the Pharaoh. What do you suppose I mean by that? This was very brilliant of him. Rosetta?
He became the king god, maybe?
Yeah, in a sense, right? By this point, it wasn't quite the same as it had been in the Age of Pyramids. But to be the pharaoh was to be the leader of the Egyptian religion. So he wasn't just going to be a foreign ruler. He was going to be the pharaoh of the Egyptians. Pretty brilliant. And so, again, he's in a way, he's going to take away that reason for people to rebel, because he's not going to force the Egyptians to give up their 3,000-year-old religion, right? Or, of course, we've seen that it changed over time. But, you know, he's not going to force them to change their culture. Instead, he made himself a part of their culture. That's pretty brilliant. So this was the idea that Cyrus had passed down, and now Cambyses was going to take it to the next level in a way, by becoming the Pharaoh of Egypt. Pretty smart. All right, so we have charismatic leadership, right, as a factor. We have just plain old military power as an ingredient to explain the Persian Empire. And we have this special technique of religious toleration as a quite brilliant method of ruling other people as well, which helped the Persians to create such a large empire. All right, but that wasn't it. So there was more. After Cambyses came Darius. So finally we can go to Darius, because I got a little bit mixed up there earlier. So, the Behistun inscription was created by whom? Darius the Great. It's not only Cyrus the Great, but, or Darius if you prefer, an American pronunciation. Darius the Great is the one whose exploits are featured on the Behistun inscription. And as we're going to see, he is the one who's going to collide with the Greeks. So here he is. Looks a lot like Hammurabi in that stele, doesn't he, right? Sitting on the throne with the footstool, with the staff. So that was definitely kind of the way that kings were. And look at that, what it says up here. King of Persia, Pharaoh of Egypt also, right? So basically he kept that going. But Darius did something else to make the Persian Empire more successful. He created the most advanced, and now I have to put another word, vocabulary word. It's a big vocabulary day. He created the most advanced bureaucracy of the archaic world. There's two words in that. One of them is also a part of this word. So, look for the common denominator there. Bureaucracy, democracy. That's not too hard, Patrick.
Cressy,
which means what? The crassy of the demos.
Oh.
The crassy of the people. Anybody remember what democracy means? Yes?
It means the majority rules.
Okay. The rule of the people. Or especially the majority. Kresi means the rule of. So bureaucracy means the rule of the bureau. Which means what? This is actually a French word. Bureau. It means officials. Officers. It means... it literally means office. Okay? The rule of the office workers. What? What do you mean, Mr. Powell? Well, what it means is that the government was organized into offices so that people are doing very special jobs and they are professionals. They do this because it's their job, and that makes the government work more efficiently. So throughout history, what we see in any country where the king needs to rule and we want to have a monarchy that works properly, what happens is, in the ones that are successful, he figures out how to have officials to do his work. Now, we've seen that Egypt had a bureaucracy. Who was the most important official in the Egyptian bureaucracy? The most important officer of the government. Underneath the pharaoh, right, Rosetta? Go ahead.
Visor.
The visor, the vizier, you guys and your visors. Okay, now the vizier, yes. And then underneath him were the nomarchs and so on. Right, so that was the way of creating a kind of bureaucracy for Egypt to organize the kingdom. While the Persians had to have a much more complicated bureaucracy because this was the size of their empire, right? So you had to have local rulers. That they knew. So the local rulers in the Persian system were called satraps. Okay, so we have, that would be kind of like a satrap, would be pretty much equal to a nomarch, right? Or a patesi, that sort of thing. A satrap was a local ruler in each of the separate parts of the empire. But what can you imagine would be a very special problem with having local rulers in an empire this big? Especially if the emperor is living in Persepolis over here in the center. Henry, Wyatt?
Oh, what I would think is that the satraps could, well, take control of their area.
Yep, they've got a lot of power, and what happens to them when they've got too much power?
They can decide. I think I would be a better ruler than that guy down in Persia.
Yeah, right, exactly. He's far away. I've got a powerful army here. I'm the local ruler. Power corrupts, right? So you want more power when you've got it. So absolutely. So here was one of the tricks that the Persians came up with, was to have a spy. He was a secretary, which just means part of a bureaucracy. If you can't have offices without secretaries, and nowadays we call them personal assistants, but we also call them secretaries. So there was always a secretary as a spy watching over the satrap. And the secretary was known as the king's ear. Which is kind of a good expression, right? So the king's ear was doing what? Can you kind of get the metaphor? What was the king's ear always doing for the king? Julia?
Listening and spying.
Exactly. Listening in on what the satrap is doing to make sure that he is loyal. Now, of course, the king's ear, who is a secretary for the satrap, might actually decide he's going to go along with the satrap. So how do you keep them both in line, right? If you got two guys, one watching the other, well, that's helpful. But what happens if they're both disloyal? So in addition to the king's ear, there was a mobile army moving throughout the empire pretty much at all times. And this was known as the king's eye. Good metaphors, right? So, the whole point was that this would have a special officer, a new bureau, right? A special official that would come and check on the satraps every once in a while by surprise. You would never know when the king's eye would appear. So if you wanted to be disloyal to the Persian king, you better watch out because the king's eye might show up. And if things were not the way they were supposed to be, then you would lose your power. The army would probably kill you or put you in prison and put in a new satrap. And probably the king's ear would lose his job too. Probably get his ears cut off. Oh, terrible thought. Okay, so the king's ear, the king's eye, the satraps, all of this was to organize the kingdom, to make it work in as efficient a way as possible, and to make sure that the king was always aware of what was going on. To make it easier to move around within the empire, the Persians started to do something which later the Romans really mastered and became the greatest at doing. They started to build roads throughout their empire. So one of those roads is actually labeled on this particular map. You can follow it here from one of the Persian capitals, Susa. This was the royal road, kind of like a superhighway through the Persian Empire, all the way to Lydia, which had been conquered by them. So this was like the central artery of the Persian Empire. You could, you know, get on a chariot and you could have horses here, kind of like your Pony Express in America, and you could really go super fast along this road from one part of the empire to the other. Certainly the most important parts of the empire were in the center here. So by having these royal roads that the Persian army could travel along, by having spies and the king's ear and the king's eye, then you could get basically, you could really organize this thing. And that's what was needed. In order to reach this level of empire, that's what you needed, to be really organized. All right, the Persians did that, but they ran into some people that didn't want to be ruled, no matter how organized those Persians were. So when we come back after the test, we're going to get to those folks. So, all right, folks, that is it for the story of the archaic world. We've reached the climax and we've reached the end. So when we come back, we'll do the test next week. And then after that, we start into the best part, Greek history. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you tomorrow in History Through Art. Bye for now.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Mr. Powell.
It was, wasn't it?
A lot.
A dose of big words there.
Hello, who's this?
Hello, parents. And hello.
Hello, Sticky Wacky.
Did you see how people said happy birthday, Patrick, in the chat?
I know, I saw.
Good. Patrick, religious. An I after the G, please. An I after the G.
Oh, thanks.
I'm going to add it to your list.
Hey!
Hey, what? Hey, it's so annoying when I do that.
Mm-hmm.
This.
You got to get the spelling right. Yes, religion needs to go. Religious needs to go on the spelling list.
Says who?
No, it sure does. Why would
says who?
What? I said so. Says me.
And write it down on your own.
Hey, be careful. Don't get lippy. Bring the iPad for me, please.